Four for the Fifth. Four radio programs for the Fifth War Loan, produced by Arch Obler and William N. Robeson for the United States Treasury. And starring on this broadcast, Mr. Conrad Nagel. This is a war not only of men and machines, but of ideas. As the fourth of this special series of broadcasts about the ideas for which we fight and those which we must fight against, we bring you E-Day, a radio document written and directed by William N. Robeson and starring Mr. Conrad Nagel.
Fellow citizens, this is a war bond program. No, don't reach for the dial, please. This war bond program is a little different. We promise to appeal to your head instead of your heart. The goal of this war loan is the sale of E-bonds to the individual purchaser. We'll try to tell you simply and perhaps entertainingly why this is so important. Since Pearl Harbor. This is your government speaking to you. Not speaking. We waited a long time for D-Day. It's come gloriously, brilliantly, successfully. Let today, then, be called E-Day, to remind us that victory is closer with every E-bond we buy. Remember Pearl Harbor? America took a beating at Pearl Harbor, and the American people took a beating for months afterwards.
The American people are complacent.
The time has come for sacrifice. We must pull in our belts. We must give till it hurts. Remember, there's a war on.
They exhorted us from pulpit and microphone. They pointed the finger of scorn at us from editorial page and news column. And many a hot-headed curbstone colonel had a simple answer for our widely advertised laxness.
What this country needs is a couple of good bombings. That'll wake them up.
It's easy to view with alarm. Criticism makes better copy. Bad news is more dramatic. There are no headlines in incidents like these.
I've been thinking it over, Mary, and I've come to the conclusion that we can do without a flower bed this year. We'll turn the whole back lawn into a victory garden.
Oh, I know the Motor Corps uniform is smarter and all that, but it seems to me I can be of more service as a nurse's aide.
Somebody's got to be on duty in this air raid post all the time, so I'll take the graveyard shift. I got insomnia anyway.
$136 million people is a lot of people. And when they all start moving in one direction, somebody's going to get run over. We started moving on December 7th, but we weren't quite sure in what direction. Then a month later, we got our orders.
125,000 airplanes, 75,000 tanks, 35,000 anti-aircraft guns, 10 million tons of ships to be produced by the end of 1943.
Golly, that's a big order.
Can't possibly make it.
Got to make it. Now stop wasting breath. Let's get going.
Yes, there were a lot of people who wondered if we could make the grade, both here and overseas.
It is easy to distinguish bluffing figures. Everybody knows that Roosevelt sees in bluffing one of the most important weapons of spiritual warfare.
How, where, and when can such a program be carried out?
The psychological warfare boys in Tokyo and Berlin kept passing the doubts at us. and a lot of us were willing to carry the ball for them. Because, you see, in this country, it doesn't cost you your head to listen to the enemy's radio.
Well, where are we going to get the stuff to make all them tanks and guns?
And when are we going to get the time? The Japs have got Singapore, Java, and Burma. That means tin and rubber and a lot of oil.
It can't be done. We're a bunch of suckers to try it. Let the Japs have what they got and Hitler, too. I say the quicker we make a deal, the better off we'll be.
That's the way a lot of us talked those days in buses and pool halls, the locker rooms and bridge clubs, never knowing we were doing a job for the enemy. But most of us, the great majority of us that never make the front page, quietly went to work. We knew without help from the viewers with alarm or the pointers with pride how great our strength was. We were the people who gave the world a new conception of liberty and freedom. We were the people who hacked our way across a continent, axe stroke by axe stroke, and carved a fabulous empire where each man is king. We were the people who built big, thought big, and talked big, and always made good our boast. We were the people who, before Betsy Ross sewed together the first stars and stripes, went to battle under a rattlesnake banner on which was blazoned the warning,
"Don't tread on me."
The machine was rolling, the course was set. We went to work on those tanks and planes and guns and ships like we once threw the railroads across the plains and the wide concrete highways over the mountains and the great skyscrapers into the heavens. But it's hard to stand back and get the whole picture. You solder connections on electrical switches all day at Kearney, New Jersey. And it's difficult to imagine that switch on the control panel of a flying fortress over Germany. Or you spot weld at Cal ship day in and day out. And you find it hard to visualize hundreds of ships like the one you're pouring the steel to. Great convoys of ships bridging the oceans of the world. They couldn't tell you how well you were doing then without tipping off the enemy. And you wondered plenty that spring 2 years ago because the news was bad. Bataan fell. Corregidor fell. And the Japs invaded the Aleutians. The war was nearer. But it still wasn't very real. You'd turn on your radio and you'd hear this kind of a war.
"All right, men. We're going to charge those lily-livered, flat-eyed so-and-sos. Come on, you pennywaists. Let's go."
And you weren't quite sure. You wondered if it was like that in the Philippines. Or you'd go to the movies.
"Now, Mother, don't you worry. Why, the skipper of my bomber is the best darn pilot in the whole Air Force. Oh, Bobby, please take care of yourself."
And you knew he was the kid who would be machine gunned by the Japs as he bailed out over enemy territory in the last sequence. And you wondered if the war was being fought along such emotionally pat lines. That spring, the war was nearer. But it still wasn't very real to most of us. But it had come home to some of us.
"The Secretary of War desires that I tender his deep sympathy to you in the loss of your husband, Private First Class John."
That spring, telegraph wires began to hum in earnest with the ultimate message of war. That spring, we began to realize what we were in for. You know, there's some things that are hard to understand. Take gasoline, for instance.
It's an outrage. What right have they got rationing gasoline here in the East while the rest of the country can get as much as they want?
That was in the spring of 42, when the beaches from Maine to Florida were filthy with the oil from torpedoed tankers.
"Why, for the love of Pete, we got oil wells sprouting all over the place down here. Ain't no sense rationing us. No sense to it at all."
The summer of 42, with the tires of the nation growing thin, and no synthetic rubber yet in sight,
They're burning up gas in airplanes and bombers, aren't they? Why can't we have some to do business with?
Well, that one doesn't deserve an answer. But the answer appeared in November. The gasoline we did without in the summer of 1942 powered the General Sherman tanks that rolled across Africa from Casablanca to the Kasserine Pass and beyond. We began to get the point then. We began to see the shape of war. The relation of distant events to the sacrifices we're asked to make at home.
Now, just a minute there.
I beg your pardon.
I've been listening to what you've been saying, and I've agreed with everything you had to say up till now.
Well, who are you?
Manstreet's the name. John J. Manstreet, American citizen.
Well, Mr. Manstreet, what do you disagree with?
You, talking about sacrifice.
Well, I...
Now, let's get down to cases. What sacrifices? Who's made any sacrifices here at home? Excepting the people who've lost a son or a husband. That's the only real sacrifice anybody's asked to make today.
Yes, that's true enough.
Do you know anyone that's going hungry today?
Well, no.
How about shoes? You know anybody that's going barefoot?
No.
The way I look at it, being just a plain American citizen, we're the luckiest people in the world. We got plenty to eat. We got plenty of clothes. We're making more money than we ever did in our history. Brother, this war's put us in clover. Look at this wallet, stuffed with the long green.
Yes, but you better look out, Mr. Manstreet. That pocketbook of yours is loaded.
What do you mean?
Well, I'll show you. What are you going to do with all that money, Mr. Manstreet?
Going shopping.
I figured as much. What are you going to buy?
Well, I haven't made up my mind yet.
How about a new car?
Sure need one.
Think you can afford it?
Why not? I'm making more dough now than I ever did in my life before. And if I could afford a new car in 39, I sure can afford one now.
Yes, guess you can at that. Now, come on, let's get down to Automobile Road.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. What can I do for you?
I want to buy an automobile.
I'm sorry, we don't make automobiles anymore.
You don't? Well, what do you make?
Jeeps and tanks and airplane motors.
Well, I haven't any use for an airplane motor on account I haven't got an airplane. And I don't think a tank would be very comfortable for the missus. So I'll take a Jeep.
I'm sorry, I can't sell you a Jeep.
I got money.
I'm sorry. Our only customer is the United States Army.
Well, that's too bad, Mr. Manstreet. No automobiles. That fat wallet doesn't seem to be much good to you.
Oh, I'll find something to buy. Now, let me see. Hey, let's go into this hardware store. Maybe I can get a new stove.
Good day, gentlemen.
Hello. Oh. Look, I'd like to see about getting a new stove.
We haven't any more stoves, only landing barges.
Oh. Well, how about an electric train? My kid's old enough for an electric train.
No more electric trains, only naval gun sights.
But I haven't got a naval gun.
Sorry.
How about a new washing machine for my wife?
No washing machines, only machine guns.
But I got money, lots of money.
Sorry, we have nothing to sell to the man in the street.
Well, can you tie that?
What'll you do with your money now, Mr. Manstreet?
I know. Let's get down to the open market. They must have something left that they'll sell to civilians.
Probably. There may be some choksies left, for instance. Do you like choksies?
Love them. Both Mrs. Manstreet and I agree they're good enough to eat.
That they are, both useful and ornamental. There's nothing like choksies.
You know, I heard the Army has bought them all up for the soldiers. Fella told me just the other day, after the open market has sold its supply, no more choksies.
Now, that would be a calamity.
Yeah, we better hurry. Hey, come on, hurry up. We'll be too late.
Certainly looks like a lot of people had the same idea you did.
Yeah. Hey, look, they're auctioning choksies.
Well, what would you expect on the open market?
Here you are, the one and only, the original choksies. They're good enough to eat. Now, what am I bid for this full-weight, one-pound package of choksies? They're good enough to eat.
25 cents.
Oh, come now. You can't get choksies like this anymore. Somebody was wanted more than that.
30 cents.
30 cents for this pre-war box of choksies? Well, remember, this is the last box in town. After that, no more choksies until after the war. Think of it. Life without choxies, they're good enough to eat.
75 cents.
$1.
$1.10.
$1.25. $1.50.
$1.75.
$2.
$2 once. $2 twice. $2 sold to the lady in the street.
My wife.
Naturally.
$2 for a box of choxies. It's outrageous.
Remember, madam, there's a war on. You're very fortunate to get the last box of choxies in town.
I suppose so. But I do declare I don't know what we're coming to, the way prices are going up.
Hello, Mary.
Oh, John, what are you doing in the open market?
Same thing you're doing, trying to spend some money. I got paid today.
You won't have much trouble spending money here in the open market. Imagine charging $2 for a 25-cent box of choxies.
Yeah, I know. It's the war, dear. They wouldn't sell me anything up the street a piece.
But it was the last box in town.
Then it was worth it.
If you don't mind me asking, ma'am, those choxies you just bought, did you need them?
Heavens, no, at least not yet. I've still got two boxes at home that I haven't opened.
Well, why did you buy them?
Well, I could afford it, and it was the last box in town. It would be simply dismal to run out of choxies. I don't know what Mr. Manstreet and I would do without choxies.
Yeah, we always say they're good enough to eat.
What did you do 5 years ago before they were put on the market?
I declare I don't know. Life wouldn't be worth living without choxies. But $2 a box. And Trolofan, the same way, priced out of sight. I had to pay 79 cents for the small size package, and just last week, there were only 65. And Prozits, 48 cents a dozen. Before the war, the very best were only 31.
I know, dear. It's that way with everything. I don't know how we're going to keep up with taxes and buy war bonds and keep a roof over our heads this winter.
There's only one thing to do, John. You march right into your boss and demand a raise. They can't expect you to keep body and soul together and raise a family on your salary the way prices are going up. What do they think we are, paying a starvation wage?
That's the way it works, Mr. Manstreet, when your pocketbook is loaded. Used to be you worked in a factory that made refrigerators or radios or automobiles. And on payday, you went out and bought a refrigerator or a radio or a new car. Now you get paid to make tanks and machine guns and aeroplanes. And what can you find to buy? Choxies, whatever they are. So you buy choxies whether you need them or not. And there aren't enough choxies to go around, so you pay fancy prices for them, and the trouble starts. It's cut and dried.
When there's more money than there are goods to spend it on, prices go up.
When prices go up, the people demand higher wages.
And with those higher wages, they bid the prices up further.
This is inflation.
Mean to say we're running into inflation?
We've managed to hold it down so far with wage and price control. But under wartime conditions, it's a constant danger.
Well, how do you stop it?
The best way I know is to stop buying what you don't need and buy something you do need and your country needs you to buy. Buy war bonds.
But I'm already buying war bonds. 10% of my salary.
Then buy more.
Isn't there any end of it?
Not until we've won the war. In wartime, no soldier can call his life his own. It belongs to his country. It's different with us folks back home. Our country does not ask for our lives, but it does ask for the loan of our pocketbooks. The only blood you'll shed in this war, Mr. and Mrs. Manstreet, is the blood you donate to the Red Cross.
Now, look here.
During this fifth war alone, we've heard a lot of fine reasons why we should buy war bonds and more war bonds. It's patriotic. It's to back the attack. It's to drive another nail in Hitler's coffin and throw another banana peel under Hirohito's snow-white horse. They're all good reasons. But here's another reason, just an ordinary common sense, dollars and cents reason. The government, which is you and me, all 136 million of us, can pay for this war in only two ways.
What are they?
Borrow from the people or borrow from the banks.
Well, why doesn't the government borrow from the banks? They've got all the money.
It would be very easy. The Treasury could have sold the entire Fifth War loan to the banks without borrowing a cent from Tom, Dick, or Harry.
Then what's all the shouting for?
Well, if the banks had bought up the loan sooner or later, that $16 billion would have been converted to cold cash, burning a hot hole in the pockets of you and me and the rest of the people. 16 more billions would have been put into circulation. When what we've got to do is take money out of circulation.
That sounds like double talk.
Well, let's see if we can simplify it. Suppose a representative of the United States Treasury walks into a banker's office with a briefcase under his arm.
Hello, J.P.
Hello, Henry.
I've got $16 billion worth of bonds in this briefcase. 2 9/10% to 75% of face value. Maturity in 10 years.
We'll take them.
Fine.
Here's a passbook with $16 billion credited to the account of the United States government.
Thanks. Afternoon, Walter.
Hello, Henry. How's the war coming along?
Looks fine today. Just floated alone.
Credit's still good, huh?
Best in the world. Got any tanks?
You bet. New 1944 models just off the line. Double recoil 105 gun. New improved fast action 50 caliber machine guns. And the interior restyled for safety and comfort. Finest model we've ever made.
Good. We'll need 10,000 of them by Tuesday.
They're yours.
Here's our check for $1 billion.
Sure it's good? Therefore, I find it impossible to accept your order for a post-war automobile at this time. First, we must win the war, yours and so forth. That'll be all, Miss Axminster.
Yes, sir.
Oh, no, just a minute. You going by the bank at lunchtime?
I can.
Better deposit this check for $1 billion.
Yes, sir. And today's payday, you know.
Oh, so it is. Well, deposit 999 million and bring back a million in cash for the payroll.
Yes, sir.
All right, boys, step up and get your dough. Sing out your name plain.
Grabowski.
$42.87. Next.
Martin.
$59.30. Next.
Pantalini.
$48.05.
This transaction is normal and legal. No credit is better than that of the United States Treasury. But it's a paper transaction. The paper the bonds were written on. The paper of the bank's passbook. The paper of the check that paid for the 1,000 tanks. And now at last, that paper becomes hard cash for the payroll. Cash in the hands of Grabowski, Pantalini, and Martin. Cash for a new dress for Mrs. Pantalini. Or the Grabowski's new hair-filled Davenport, or a box of Choxies for Steve Martin's girl. And as the Treasury uses up the $16 billion credit to buy the tools and supplies of war, it eventually appears in the tills and cash registers of the country as $16 billion additional dollars to help push prices higher. Get the point, Mr. Manstreet?
Yeah, that seems to make sense.
But the Treasury doesn't want to sell bonds to the banks. It sells them instead to Mr. Grabowski and Mr. Martin and Mr. Pantalini, and to you, Mr. Manstreet. And if it sells enough of them, what happens?
The Grabowskis don't get a new Davenport.
They have an old one that'll do till the war's over.
Steve Martin's girl doesn't get any Choxies.
They're good enough to eat, but they're not worth what they cost.
Mrs. Pantalini doesn't get her new silk dress.
She has three nearly new ones anyway.
And I don't get a fur coat.
No, not now. Not when prices are too high anyway and merchandise is inferior. But while you're getting by with as few expenditures as possible, your investment in your country's future is increasing in value against the time when you'll be able to buy better coats and dresses and furniture and automobiles than you ever dreamed of today. It may be sacrifice now,
but... Sacrifice? Mister, that's the best deal I ever heard of.
Ladies and gentlemen, the invasion of Europe has just begun. The invasion of Japan has yet to come. There is much bitter struggle ahead of us before we've won the unconditional surrender, which is our only guarantee of a decent world. It's not a figure of speech. It's not an emotional overstatement. It's true that every war bond you buy shortens the time until victory. No citizen has a more solemn duty than this.
Back the attack! Buy more than before!
have just heard Mr. Conrad Nagel in E-Day, a radio document written and directed by William N. Robeson. The original musical score was composed and conducted by David Brookman. This has been the last of a special series of radio programs, Four for the Fifth, produced by Arch Obler and William N. Robeson for the United States Treasury. In the spirit of our worldwide attack, we bring you the stirring United Nations On the March of Dmitri Shostakovich with James Newell and the Treasury Chorus and Orchestra under the direction of David Brookman.
The sun and the stars all are ringing with song rising strong from the earth. The hope of humanity singing a hymn to a new world in birth. United Nations on the march with flags unfurled. Together fight for victory, a new free world.
The sun and the stars brightly shining, a song rising strong from the earth. The hope of humanity singing, a hymn to a new world in birth. United Nations on the march with flags unfurled. Together fight for victory, a new free world.
Take heart, all you nations swept under by powers of darkness that ride. The wrath of the people shall thunder, relentless as time and the tide. United Nations on the march with flags unfurled.
Together fight for victory, a new free world.
Together fight for victory, a new
many ways of saying buy bonds, and here's how Barry Wood says it.
We raised an army of 10 million Yanks, and it's only the beginning. We built 200,000 planes and tanks, and it's only the beginning. We bought bonds and then we bought bonds again. And if you think we're done, why, we've only begun. We're gonna buy bonds, come on and buy bonds. Stock 'em with each dollar that you lend. For us, it's only the beginning. For them, the beginning of the end.
We raised an army of 10 million Yanks, and it's only the beginning. We built 200,000 planes and tanks, and it's only the beginning. We bought bonds and then we bought bonds again. And if you think we're done, why, we've only begun. We're gonna buy bonds, come on and buy bonds. Suck 'em with each dollar that you lend. For us, it's only the beginning.
There were those who said we couldn't do it, and we did what they said we couldn't do. Uncle Sam got there in time, and brother, you can bet They ain't seen nothing yet. We raised an army of 10 million Yanks.
And it's all been the beginning.
We built 200,000 planes and tanks.
And it's all been the beginning.
We bought bonds and then we bought bonds again. And if you think we're done, why, we've only begun. We're gonna buy bonds, come on and buy bonds.
Stock 'em with each dollar that you lend.
For us, it's only the beginning. For them, the beginning of the end.